I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's June 6th, and we have a lot to talk about. Last week, I was in Aurora, Colorado, attending the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual conference. And one of the things that makes this conference unique is that there's less of an emphasis on research and more of an emphasis on new options for treating the various symptoms of MS that are available today. So this is a conference where, in addition to neurologists, you see a lot more MS nurses, rehabilitation specialists, and others who work directly with people living with MS. And for the second year in a row, I set up my podcasting gear at the National MS Society's booth in the exhibit hall and captured a few interviews. My first conversation was with Dr. Kathy Zukowski, the MS Society's Associate Vice President of Research. If you're a regular listener, you might recall that Dr. Zukowski joined me last year at this same meeting, and I thought she gave us such a great overview of some of the sessions and presentations that caught her eye that I invited her to share some of this year's presentations that she found to be particularly interesting. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Kathy Zukowski. I'm talking with Dr. Kathy Zukowski, the Associate Vice President of Research at the National MS Society. And first, I want to thank you for joining me here at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting for 2 years in a row. Your report on last year's conference was just so great that I wanted to be sure to invite you back again this year. So welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Zukowski.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be back.
So before we get to the conference itself, more generic question, I guess. Why do researchers and clinicians and rehabilitation specialists and MS nurses, why do they all come to conferences and meetings like this one?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because if you haven't experienced it, it's hard to explain. The benefit really is that we get to meet face-to-face. It's a little awe-inspiring to meet someone who you've read their work. You really like the work they're doing, but they live around the world or a different state. And so to meet them and actually have the opportunity to talk to them face-to-face, ask questions, see some of their work, it's very inspiring. And it makes, at least me, it makes me kind of come back to my work and go in kind of new directions or have new ideas for my work.
Now let's get to it. Can you give us a bit of a download on what you've seen and heard at this year's conference?
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, it's such a, it really is inspiring to be surrounded by a few thousand MS experts. And this meeting is wonderful in that it provides a platform to highlight different aspects of care, from understanding the impact of health disparities on the MS journey to learning about the impact of aging and telomere length as a marker of disease progression and disability, to learn about novel imaging analyses that focus on using all these already acquired imaging data to track progression, all the way to the other side of the spectrum, learning how communication can be augmented for people with MS, how to address symptoms of fatigue and insomnia. And such variety is one thing that makes this meeting so unique and so important to improving MS care. So I wanted to highlight a couple of things that I've gone to and found valuable, and I hope that your listeners will find it valuable too. One workshop focused on augmentative and alternative communication controls for people with MS. And this was presented by a speech therapist, an occupational therapist, and a physical therapist. And going into this meeting, I don't think I would have understood that the OT and PT have a role in augmenting communication, but I would be found wrong. So they defined augmentative communication as tools used to add to a person's speech, and alternative communication are tools used instead of a person's speech. So Rachel Haynes, a speech language pathologist, focused on communication deficits in people with MS, and she recommends some tools that are low-tech, like engaging a partner to assist, using a communication board, using a thumb switch, and that these tools are specific to a person's situation. They're affordable and they're easy to create. but there are also lots of high-tech tools. So applications that are text or picture-based that can be downloaded on tablets or smartphones. One in particular that caught my ear was called Open Sesame, and this uses head tracking to navigate a talking keyboard. So speech-generating devices are used to provide an alternative form of communication for individuals that are unable to use verbal speech. And apparently this happens to a significant percentage of some people with MS. They can create a synthesized voice for communication as an alternative form of communication, and they can be used to control things in their environment, like lights or temperature or door locks. So this can really allow someone to have increased communication independence. There are also some voice amplification systems that they described, and Rachel described how voice amplification is often not covered by insurance, but then she pointed out a few affordable options that you can find online. The occupational therapist also came on and described their role as evaluating upper extremity function, cognition, visual skills, and fatigue, since all of these things impact a person's communication. So OTs would recommend electronic aids for daily living, adapting a person's access to a computer mouse or for typing on a computer, adapting a keyboard to use high contrast colors and text, and even providing training in energy conservation and for using consumer home control options like Siri or Google. The physical therapist would really focus on seating, postural support, proper positioning of the hips and the pelvis, core strengthening, and respiratory support, along with mobility. And they made it really clear that using kind of good sitting posture is important to communication and can really affect a person's ability to breathe and speak loudly enough to be heard. And the PT described a lot of small additions that can be made to, say, a wheelchair to keep a person well-aligned and comfortable and give them kind of the best opportunity to use their trunk and respiratory muscles in a healthy way when communicating. So I left this workshop, I guess, feeling a little bit more informed about how the rehab team, a speech therapist, OT, and PT, kind of worked together on something that to me seemed like very much a speech therapy issue, which was verbal communication.
That is so interesting. And I think sometimes people overlook the fact that speech is one of the areas that gets affected. It's right up there with swallowing and all of those other mechanisms, oral mechanisms, that can be affected by MS.
Yeah, exactly. It was good to see that they had some space at this conference for others to listen and hear that too.
Yes.
Okay, I want to tell you about another one. So there's a talk describing the management of sleep disorders in MS. So many of you may know that sleep disorders are really 2 to 3 times more common in MS compared to the general population. And this could be due to insomnia or breathing disorders, restless leg syndrome, or periodic limb movement disorders. And scientists describe damage to the central nervous system in several specific areas of the brain. And sleep disorders can be impacted by medications also that are used to relieve common MS symptoms like spasticity and pain, depression, or anxiety. All of these things affect sleep, and behavioral complications also affect sleep, like changes in employment, napping, worrying, and ruminating, as well as feelings of helplessness. So how do you treat sleep issues? That's what I went to this meeting really looking for. And what Dr. Abby Hughes described was that early treatment and even prevention is really, really important. And that most issues become chronic, not because of the initial diagnosis, but because of behaviors that reinforce the symptoms. So that a first line of treatment for insomnia is cognitive behavioral therapy. And that this addresses pathways between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And there was described kind of a circle of, you know, thoughts create feelings, feelings create behaviors, and behavior reinforces thoughts. So this approach of cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to improve sleep and reduce fatigue and depression and improve cognitive symptoms. And that these kinds of approaches have been adapted specifically for MS. And lastly, Dr. Hughes is currently evaluating the efficacy of a 4-week remotely delivered cognitive behavioral therapy intervention for improving sleep and sleep quality, as well as how it might affect MS symptoms specifically. And the preliminary data looks really promising, and I would love to hear the final results for this study when it's completed. So it might be great to think about having an intervention specific to MS, and that could be done remotely. So maybe Dr. Hughes could come on and explain this when she's finished.
I was going to say, when you're ready to hear the outcome of that study, I have a great podcast to recommend to you. And again, I think, you know, we're talking about a couple of areas that are fairly common among people with MS, speech issues and sleep disorders, but sometimes get overlooked. They are not top of mind. And the thing about a sleep disorder, if you're not getting quality sleep, boy, it can ruin your whole next day. I mean, it really can get in the way of doing well at work. It can make you short-tempered. It can affect your relationships with others. It can do all sorts of things. And so, almost like a set of dominoes, you have MS symptoms that drive sleep disorders, which themselves then drive their own set of problems.
Right. I think that's exactly, it's a vicious circle. And addressing some of these small issues that might start small, like a sleep issue, might avoid some of the bigger issues, that some of the bigger symptoms that might come up. I wanted to tell you about one other symptom-based intervention that I think your listeners might be interested in, and that is understanding fatigue and its clinical management. So fatigue is very common, and people with MS report fatigue as a very significant problem for them. So it's a concept we all know, but it's been very difficult to define. It's often discussed in terms of a decline in performance. But we know more about what fatigue is not than what fatigue is. So it was made clear in this symposium that fatigue is not depression. Fatigue is not sleepiness. It is not weakness or cognitive impairment. These symptoms might be associated, but even fatigue and sleep are associated with distinct brain networks. And that there's a lack of association between perceived fatigue, so how fatigued I feel, versus how this affects my actual performance. And I heard some really interesting work that I want to share with you about our understanding of fatigue. So one researcher, Glenn Wiley at the Kessler Foundation, Dr. Glenn Wiley, he talked about the fact that individuals with MS expend more cognitive resources, so more effort, to perform a given task compared to people that don't have MS. And this may skew the balance between effort and reward. So fatigue may be the brain's way of signaling this decrease in payoff and reward. So can rewards be used to reduce fatigue? And so they explored this, and they showed that if you offer rewards to reach a goal that's important to you, that the fatigue improves. So the hypothesis was that maybe fatigue is kind of a self-organizing system in a way that kind of tells us that a task is no longer worth pursuing. So this is all very, very preliminary, but I thought it was interesting to think about this idea of can we find a motivator that is important or valued by each person and use that as the reward? And that might make it easier to do some tasks that are found to be very fatiguing. It was also described in this symposium that there is no evidence that pharmacologic treatments really improve fatigue. But because we don't know, we don't have a lot of other interventions, that's often still prescribed. So I might ask your physicians, if they are prescribing these medications, what they are expecting to see in terms of improvement. They talked also about there is good support for cognitive behavioral therapy. I've mentioned this earlier, it's kind of this goal-oriented psychotherapy that takes a hands-on, practical approach to problem solving, as well as balance training. And that both of these types of interventions have pretty good support for improving fatigue. But once you might do it for a period of time with a trained professional, but that you might actually need booster sessions maybe 6 months or a year later to maintain those benefits that you see. So I wanted, you know, I feel like fatigue is always such a big problem. And they're really, the best evidence is really that cognitive behavioral therapy or balance exercises seem to be the most important intervention at this point. But this idea of maybe figuring out what you value as a person with MS and making goals associated with rewards that are important to you might be another alternative option in treating fatigue.
You brought up a few really important things. I think reminding people that there was a large-scale clinical trial that looked at the most commonly prescribed medications for fatigue, and none of them were shown to be effective. I think that's important, especially if you're someone who wants to be careful about not having to take too many different medications. You may want to see how you're going to do without one of these medications.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the same time, although it's counterintuitive, I've heard, and this is sort of right up your alley, I've heard that more physical activity, exercise, actually has been shown to help mitigate fatigue. So obviously not during someone feeling fatigued, but before you get to that point, doing more physically can help mitigate some of the fatigue you're used to feeling. Is that right?
Exactly. And it seemed like balance exercises seem to be better than aerobic exercise in these current studies. So this is, again, all these studies, please take with their, you know, a grain of salt, so to speak, in that they are smaller studies, but this is the best we have. This is the cutting edge research that we know of right now in MS.
This is not a reported outcome. So I'll anonymize all the aspects of it. But I was speaking with an investigator who's involved in a clinical trial right now that is looking at exercise for a number of different reasons among people who are living with MS. And what that investigator shared with me is the people in this study are telling him that one said, gee, I haven't been able to get into my garden for the last 5 years, and now I am up and I'm gardening, and it's not just because I have the physical ability, I have the energy to get out and do it. So it's a kind of thing that can impact your quality of life in ways that you may not be thinking about at the moment, but you certainly recognize when you run up against an obstacle and you can't do something because of fatigue.
Yeah, and I really encourage people to think about if there's something you're giving up because of your MS, like gardening, that is tangible like that, to bring it to your physical therapist, your occupational therapist, or even your physician, and find out, are there ways I can adapt this so that would drive me to be able to reach that goal? And from what the studies are showing, that could be improving your fatigue.
I'll also put in a suggestion to everyone that if your treating physician is not bringing up the subject, you might want to ask the question, how can physical therapy help me? Or how could occupational therapy give me more day-to-day activity that I'm capable of doing? How can they help me do the things I love to do? So if they're not asking you, by all means, you can ask them, and certainly bring up the subject and see if you can't find solutions that may not be apparent at first glance.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. I think that's a great plug for rehab. lastly, I wanted to share with you some new guides that the National MS Society has created this year that I think your listeners might be interested in.
Sure.
So one of them is called What to Expect from Rehabilitation Care, a Guide for People with MS. And this provides information about rehabilitation, wellness, and health maintenance. It explains the roles of the rehab team and the importance of early treatment. And it attempts to outline what to expect from a rehab evaluation. So you can really determine if this is the direction you'd like to go, and maybe even understanding maybe what you're missing. There's a second one too. And then the second one is called What to Expect from Mental Health Care, a Guide for People with MS. And this covers types of mental health diagnoses, options for seeking providers, strategies to use right now to improve emotional well-being, and resources for further investigation. And in this particular case, this guide has also been translated into Spanish and is also available. So I will make those available to you, John, to share.
And I will make sure that they are available. I'll make sure there is a link in today's show notes. And if you happen to have the Real Talk MS app on your iOS or Android phone or tablet, you will see those guides appear under your bonus content tab. So they're going to be on their way to you. You know, I think we could be doing ourselves a big favor if we reminded people that rehabilitation is also about retraining. A lot of times, I think people make the assumption that if I injure myself, if I hurt myself, I need to rehabilitate that injury. But very often, a rehabilitation professional can help you modify the way you get things done and provide new ways of getting things done. And so it's also as much retraining as it is rehabbing, isn't it?
Right. I mean, rehab, I feel like, is kind of two-pronged, right? We want to teach any ways to adapt or compensate for the issues a person might have. And then, you know, we also want to determine ways to affect the biology of the condition. And I think there is research right now looking at both of those. But things we can use right now are all of these compensatory approaches.
Fantastic. As always, I appreciate you coming by and giving my listeners a word's eye view of the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting. And I'm going to be looking for you next year. Fair warning.
That's great. Thank you so much for giving me the chance to share some of this information. And it's great to have you here at the meeting, too.
Another event that takes place at the Consortium of MS Centers annual conference is the presentation of the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Awards. This year, 11 recipients were recognized in fields that included neurology, neuroimaging, rehabilitation, mental health, nursing, research, patient advocacy, pharmacy, patient care, and global impact. And two Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Award recipients stopped by the National MS Society's booth to talk with me. Dr. Anthony Feinstein was recognized with the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Award in the field of mental health. Dr. Feinstein is a longtime friend of the podcast, and among other topics, he and I talked about some of the new research that's emerging about a possible connection between depression and cognitive dysfunction among people living with MS. I'm talking with Dr. Anthony Feinstein, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Feinstein's expertise is in the neuropsychiatry of multiple sclerosis. While he's researched behavioral disorders in people living with MS for more than 25 years, Dr. Feinstein also maintains a busy clinical practice, a practice in which over 80% of the patients are people living with MS. Welcome, Dr. Feinstein, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, John. Very pleased to be here.
You're being honored this evening as a recipient of the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Mental Health Award. So first, congratulations.
Thank you.
You and I have talked about mental health on the podcast before. I think it's an important subject. Depression is something that I see getting in the way of, well, someone engaging in almost every aspect, every other area of their life. 50% of the people diagnosed with MS will experience depression. To put that in some context for my listeners, it's one out of every two people living with MS. So what do we know about depression and multiple sclerosis?
As you say, you know that it's common. You know that it's going to affect many people with disease. You know that it is often overlooked in clinical practice, that the diagnosis is missed, which means that it's undertreated. We now know that it's probably the single biggest factor that determines quality of life, or certainly one of the biggest factors. There's emerging data to show that it might have a negative effect on cognition, so it further increases the cognitive deficits that people with MS suffer from. You know that it is linked to suicide, and sadly suicide rates in people with MS are elevated compared to the general population and many other neurological disorders. So the reach of depression in the lives of people with MS is extensive.
You mentioned that it sometimes gets overlooked and therefore gets left untreated, which is such a tragedy, because while there may not be a cure for multiple sclerosis, depression is treatable if someone is referred to the proper professionals who can help them with that. If someone is experiencing depression, when is it time for them to talk with a professional?
Right. So, like anything in medicine, the sooner you identify the problem, the better it is. You don't want to live with depression for month after month, year after year, because of the consequences of depression. And remember this, it's very hard for family members or loved ones to live with someone who's got a depression, because the sadness can permeate the household, the family, can affect children, etc. So there are compelling reasons why you want to treat it early. And that's why clinicians need to be alert to its presence and to ask patients about depression.
You know, while we're talking about treatment, the COVID-19 pandemic made telehealth a common practice out of necessity. Has telehealth been shown to be effective in treating mental health?
Well, I'll give you my clinical experience. 90% of my clinical work now is remote. Patients are not coming back to hospitals for their mental health therapy. The pandemic has demonstrated that we can reach them in their homes, and that's where they want to stay. It's much more convenient to be at home and to sign in to see your psychiatrist than to find a taxi or negotiate traffic or to pay for expensive parking and to come wait in a waiting room. So I'm part of a large psychiatric practice where the corridors are now empty. Patients are not coming back into tertiary care centers for their mental health therapy. The pandemic has fundamentally changed the model of how we administer care. Now the question is it as good? You know, research suggests that you might miss some of the subtleties of a mental state assessment when you do it virtually, but for the most part, it seems to be working. And so we've got an outcome from the pandemic that we couldn't have anticipated, which is that patients prefer this new model of care. And because the consumer dictates how we provide the care, I think this is going to be the situation going forward.
That's remarkable. Switching gears for a minute, you mentioned something I wanted to pick up on. I was going to actually ask you whether there is a connection between behavioral disorders and cognition among people living with MS.
Right. So there's an emerging literature to suggest that if you've got a clinically significant depression, it might come with added consequences for your cognition. It might slow down your processing speed even further. It might make your memory less efficient. It could even affect your executive functioning or your problem-solving abilities. So that's something to bear in mind. Anxiety may do the same. Research is not as well developed as it is with depression, but there is some evidence that anxiety might also have some cognitive effects in people with multiple sclerosis. My lab has shown that when you've got MS and anxiety and depression, in other words, comorbid depression, anxiety in the context of MS, that's probably the worst thing for your cognition.
I think I'm going to ask a chicken and egg question that I believe you've already started answering. Do the behavioral disorders influence cognition, or does cognitive dysfunction influence behavior?
Great question. And you have to tease out the direction of causality over here. You know, we're assuming that when you're very depressed, plus minus with anxiety, that this is going to disturb your cognition. The other side of the coin is, if I'm cognitively impaired and I can't do the kind of things that I want to do, could that potentially make you depressed? The answer is yes. But we still have to do the studies to tease out that direction of causality.
A moment ago, I mentioned that depression is something that can keep someone from engaging in almost every other area of life, and that would presumably include their job. Can behavioral disorders that someone living with MS might experience interfere with their ability to be successful at work?
Right, so that actually is a topic of a talk that we're giving tomorrow. There's a seminar at the consortium devoted to employment and the factors that could influence it. The depression data is interesting. There's some studies that say yes, other studies say no. The studies that say no come up with other variables, such as if I don't engage in leisure pursuits as much, that could affect my ability to sustain employment, which I think is very relevant. If you look at the data very carefully, you will find that depression impedes a person's ability to engage in leisure pursuits. And so depression may be the hidden factor behind these kind of variables that are exerting a negative effect on employment. So we need to go back and look at this very carefully, because the data right now is a little mixed, but I think with careful inquiry, we're going to be able to tease out the role of depression in other factors such as leisure pursuits that could explain why people retain their jobs.
I know I've had conversations before with others about rehabilitation for people living with MS, and very frankly, my own personal opinion based on observation that I've seen is it really doesn't matter what sorts of wonderful treatment or activities or anything else await that patient outside the door if they're not inclined to get out of bed because they're living with depression. Mm-hmm. To me, that is the 800-pound gorilla that is blocking the gateway to all those other experiences.
You said it very well. That's exactly it. I mean, I don't think I can say it better. That if you're amotivated because of depression, if you lack the drive, if you're so despondent and so despairing of life that you don't see any hope down the road, then it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to engage that person in meaningful rehabilitation. And that's just another example of the reach of depression, how it can basically short-circuit or circumvent people getting the necessary help.
Well, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, thank you for all you do to improve the quality of life for people affected by MS. Congratulations on being honored with the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Mental Health Award here at the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure, John. It's always lovely talking to you.
I also had an opportunity to speak with the recipient of this year's Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Global Impact Award, the president and CEO of the National MS Society, Cindy Zagiboilo. Joining me is the president and CEO of the National MS Society, Cindy Zagiboilo. Welcome to the podcast, Cindy.
Hi, John. Great to be with you.
And congratulations on being honored this evening as the recipient of the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Global Impact Award. You know, when I heard about your award, it occurred to me that having a global impact on MS was always the plan for Sylvia Lowery when she founded the National MS Society, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. World free of MS, well, she didn't quite coin that term, was always in her mind. She, of course, was interested in curing her brother Bernard. That was her first, foremost everything that she wanted to accomplish. And she didn't care where in the world those solutions were found. She just wanted to find a cure. So she was always interested in what the world knew about MS and how it could help her brother.
You know, speaking of making a global impact, we were together about 3 weeks ago in New York when the Society convened the Pathways to Cures Global Summit, which brought together the best and brightest minds in MS, the CEOs of major MS societies, representatives from industry, and people affected by MS. How would you describe the summit? And now that it's been a few weeks, what's your takeaway from that meeting?
Well, it's a milestone. The summit was a milestone. We had planned for it to be, and it was. It delivered. So when we were able to have the publication of in the MS Journal, Pathways to Cures Roadmap, we knew that we couldn't waste any time planning a global convening activity because we wanted to maintain the momentum and accelerate the momentum of the progress we were making. And once we declared international consensus, everybody agrees this is the plan to cure MS, then we know that we have to continue to create spaces for smart people to come together to share progress and to continue to refine and think about what's next. And that did that. Considering all the science that was described, the summary of the 3 days I thought was really well put together and gives us some very, very clear next steps to keep moving forward.
At the very beginning of the summit, you said, we've never been better positioned to change the world for people with MS. What is it about right now that brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I think because we are such a strong movement, and we need more people to join the movement, so I just want to put that plug in there as well. We don't quite have everybody engaged and on board, but we have so many of the different players sitting at the same table, people with MS, scientists, clinicians, advocacy groups, all sitting together, focused on what we want to achieve. And we have a plan. It's not, you know, that we didn't think about putting together a plan in the past. It's that the information and the science and the understanding of MS wasn't close enough to put together a legitimate plan to cure MS. And so we boldly, I'd say that, yeah, this is time. It's time to do this, and we are ready to move forward and declare a plan and then work on it.
We talk, especially on this podcast, we talk a lot about research. And, I mean, it is what drives the future. But at some point, someone listening might be wondering, well, that research is great. What does it get us? Well, what it gets us is it gets us to this moment where we can take what really I see as a quantum leap in terms of finishing the work that still needs to be done.
I think that's right. And to recognize, one of the things I think that I hope people understand and realize is that a cure isn't a light switch. And we talk about cures. There's multiple cures. And it's not one thing that one person can do to create a cure for another person. It's not going to work that way. It requires agency of people who have MS to understand and to take steps. And it requires the passion and fueling and brilliance of researchers, scientists, and clinicians to recognize opportunities and to solve the challenges, to understand what there is, what we don't yet understand. But we all have to be working together to really make that very, very significant progress. It's not one thing that's going to do it. Everybody's going to plug in and support.
Well, to me, that's what defines the MS movement, is whether you are someone who's living with MS, whether you are a caregiver for someone with MS, whether you're a researcher or a clinician or a rehabilitation specialist, there is a role that you must play to get everyone in the movement over the finish line in their own way.
That's right. And every role is important. You know, I've been in plenty of research meetings where we have purposefully connected people who have MS or are affected by MS with scientists. And just that's just that little example of recognizing how passion is fueled both ways. If we didn't have people with MS, we wouldn't have scientists studying MS. If we didn't have scientists studying MS, we wouldn't be making progress in MS. So people with MS telling their stories, how this affects them, what they'd like to see in their future, what they'd like to have different, fuels the passion and excitement and interest in scientists and clinicians to make that happen, to have that mutual goal.
You're just describing all the reasons I started this podcast, you know. I came face to face with that passion and commitment on the part of the research community that I had not been exposed to before. And when I saw it, I was encouraged. I was really encouraged about the future for people who are affected by MS. And it occurred to me, maybe if more people knew and experienced that level of commitment and passion, they might feel a little more encouraged too. And so here we are today doing this. You know, I know it's a particularly busy time for you. 10 days from now, you'll be in Vienna for the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress. You know that the work the Alliance does is important to me, and I'm proud to have served as a member of the Alliance Scientific Steering Committee for several years. What can you tell us about the upcoming Scientific Congress?
Did you say 10 days from now?
Afraid so.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's coming up fast. And what I would like to say about the whole Progressive MS Alliance in general is just how that experience of bringing together the Progressive MS Alliance members and building the alliance over the past, I think it's 13 years since we started the alliance, was 20, maybe not quite 11 years or so. Seems like it's been there for a long time. It feels like an institution because we are so focused in moving forward. But we established the Progressive MS Alliance because there weren't any solutions for progressive MS. That there was a dearth of of options. And we wanted to make sure that people knew that we're seeing progressive MS. We're seeing people with progressive MS, and we want to provide solutions and options for them and make sure that the science moves in the right direction. So we will be extending that in Vienna. We will be listening to the progress that we've made. We'll be hearing from scientists, and we'll be moving all of that work forward.
You know, when I look at how the Progressive MS Alliance brought the world together in a collaborative global response to progressive MS, I see some similarities to how Pathways to Cures Global Research Initiative has evolved. You know, as I've heard you say before, no one affected by MS cares where the cures come from. And engaging the world seems to have proven itself to be a very worthwhile strategy.
I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think there's any doubt. And as we bring and even have the same language around MS and what the various cures can be, and we can communicate with each other better. We don't all speak the same language. English is not our first language for everyone. And so we need those tools to be able to understand each other perfectly so that we can put together the pieces of the puzzle. We can pave the way toward cures faster. And I think the Progressive MS Alliance gave us that boldness to say, okay, we brought people together. We brought the world together to focus on progressive MS. What about cures? We can do that here, too.
One more thing that's coming up in very short order is the Black MS Experience Summit, a virtual event that's taking place June 14th and 15th. What can you tell me about this event?
Well, I just heard that we have over 2,000 people registered currently. So we are that was our goal, and we still have time. And so what we're finding is that we are building momentum. We don't have a cap. We're looking for more people to come on. And if history is a predictor of the future, then I am going to assume, we'll find out after the summit happens, that 20 to 30% of those people who are registered this year are new to the society. And that gets us to what you and I just talked about a little bit earlier, yep, bringing everybody on board. So momentum is building. We're proving ourselves around building a Black MS community so that people can see themselves, they can get what they need, they can feel included, and they can contribute to the movement. We need everybody on board.
You know, the Black MS Experience Summit takes place annually, but diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's been baked into the National MS Society's DNA. It's reflected in the Society's mission statement, and I don't know if my listeners are aware, but every meeting or event hosted by the National MS Society begins with a reading of both the Society's mission statement and its diversity, equity, and inclusion statement. Can you talk about the importance of the Society's efforts in continuing to be intentional when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Well, I just came from one of our employee resource groups called Inclusive Voices, which is a group of people who historically have been left out. And we talked about the fact that Juneteenth is coming up. And we talked about the meaning of Juneteenth. And it was a powerful, powerful session where people also recognize that the society is determined and committed from the inside out. So there's an expectation at the National MS Society, and we have about 850 employees, there's an expectation that everyone will go through a process of examination, will learn about diversity, will be committed to being inclusive, and will progress from where they are to be better humans. And we support each other in that work. And it is work. It's a body of work. It's also extremely motivating and enlightening and builds us up. So it's very exciting. It can also be difficult, you know, because you learn some things about some baked-in biases that you might have that were hurtful and hard to understand. And and hard to then recognize that that's a part of you, part of me, and to change. And so we have an incredibly supportive community, and we want to make sure that everybody can feel included. And we have to start with ourselves, with our staff, with the people on board, so that we can invite more and more people in.
As you said, sometimes this work can be difficult. And I am personally so impressed by the Society's efforts because, very frankly, over the past 12 to 18 months, we've seen lots of organizations in both the private and public sector back away from their initial commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the Society has baked it into their DNA. It is not something that can be teased out. And that is very much to the credit of the National MS Society.
Thank you, John. I agree. I mean, we are persistent. We know how to be persistent. We don't get tired of working hard. And I think that's what Sylvia Lowry, our founder, described. And we remain focused and persistent and consistent. So we have, I know there were some organizations that put together entire DEI staff and really focused on putting DEI in a place in their organization. And from the very beginning said, we're not going to do that. We did hire Nisha Fredericks, who you've interviewed on this podcast before. I thought she was brilliant, by the way. And she and we hired her as our vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion because we needed that consultant. We needed somebody to help us grow from within. And she has done that and also built a work team that's interdepartmental to make sure that we continue to be focused and we continue to energize ourselves and to remain true to our belief that diversity, equity, and inclusion will get us all there faster so that we can create a world free of MS.
Well, Cindy Zaghi-Boyla, thank you for everything that the National MS Society does to impact and improve the lives of people affected by MS. Congratulations again on being honored with the Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Global Impact Award here at the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure.
This seems to be the season for MS conferences, and in just a few days, I'll be heading to Vienna to attend the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress. After spending about 7 years as a member of the Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, I'm looking forward to connecting with some of the committee members that I haven't seen in person since we were together in February 2020, just days before COVID-19 changed everything for all of us. I'm also looking forward to being updated on the latest Progressive MS research that's being funded by the Alliance, and to capturing interviews with some of the best and brightest minds in progressive MS research. While I'm there, I'm hosting a live global webcast from Vienna on Thursday, June 15th, and you'll find a link to register for that webcast in today's show notes. So I hope you're going to be joining me live from Vienna next week. That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/301. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.